when you're in that window of time, like, what is your coping mechanism? A lot of people just put the blinders on. It's like, did I have a backup plan? Yes, it was hard. Yes, we were doing like 16-hour days, 7 days per week. We had been doing it for 8 months at that point. We were trying to build something that we felt like had proof of value and enough users and usage in order to get to the first round of funding. And we asked each other this, hey, do we still want to do this? We were all like, I wouldn't trade off being anywhere else and doing anything else. So let's just keep going. That is kind of like the entrepreneurial journey.
Before we dive in, I want to extend a warm invitation to join our thriving founder community. It's the perfect place to discover more insightful interviews aimed at helping you build, grow, and scale your business. So don't forget to hit subscribe. Your support means the absolute world to us. Thank you so much for subscribing. Let's get stuck in today's discussion.
Hear the stories, learn the proven methods, and accelerate your growth and future through entrepreneurship. Welcome to the Founder Podcast with Nathan Chan.
All right, so welcome, Joe. The first question that I ask everyone that comes on is, how did you get your job, aka how did you find yourself doing the work you're doing today?
Yeah, you kind of have to go all the way back, which is went to school at a university called Indiana University, and I was an econ major there. And my freshman year was 2008, which a lot of people have pegged in their head as like the great financial crisis. And so when you're your freshman year and you're looking at what internships that you might go and get and spend the summer doing, it was all at these financial institutions that I wasn't a huge believer in. And so I had kind of like this crisis moment relatively early on in my college experience, which was, I don't know that I want to do anything associated with my degree if this is like where I'm going to end up. And so that summer, I went home and just started talking to my childhood best friend who went to a school called University of Illinois, which will be important later. And he is an industrial design major. And he was like, hey, I actually just started an agency. I'm working with like local businesses at this college town, but I do web design and development with them. You can get Adobe Creative Suite for free through university. And so why don't you just, I'll teach you some things and you can bring that back to school. And so I started a design agency, quote unquote, started. I rode on the rails of my friends. And I actually fell in love with the process of designing and building products. And then I ended up doing that full time at school and then for a year after school. And we decided that we could do the agency anywhere. So we moved out to Los Angeles together. And that's when I started working with software companies. And I saw that software companies, they had an exponential model, whereas an agency model is linear, hours in equals dollars out. So I was like, okay, I got to figure out this software thing. And I got a job offer to be a product manager with my favorite client at the time, which is a 15-person startup. It was called MediaPass. And they're like, do you want to come on full-time as a product manager? I was like, sounds great. Like, let me think about it. I went home and I literally Googled, what is a product manager? Like, what do they do? And it was like this perfect confluence of kind of like analytical perspective, which is like my econ background, and then design and building great products, which is what I had been doing with the design agency, and then business strategy, which sounds cool, you know, and like thought I wanted to do a little bit of that too. And so took that full-time gig, did that for about a year. Then I moved on and was a director of product at a different company. But I'd gotten the entrepreneurial bug when I had a design agency. I always like to say, like, I'm kind of a bad employee, honestly. Like, if I diverge from strategy or perspective, like, I'm a pain in the butt to my bosses and my bosses' bosses. And so I was fortunate to meet Vinay and Shahid, my two co-founders of Loom. And the reason why University of Illinois was important is that Vinay was randomly doing a motorcycle trip from San Francisco down to San Diego. I was living in LA at the time, and he started hitting up people on Facebook Messenger, being like, we're not going to make it all the way to San Diego. We just need a place to crash for the night. So fortunately, he had hit up my roommate. And so Vinay crashed with me for that night. We spent like 6 hours talking into the wee hours of the morning. I was like, okay, I gotta like latch on to this guy. He's brilliant. And he was our CTO. And then we just became fast friends and we started working on something together. And yeah, we can get into the founding story of Loom, but that was kind of like the series of events that led up to starting Loom.
Yeah, there you go. And so you started Loom, what, 2018, 2019, right?
No, earlier than that. This is the classic, like, eight-year overnight success story. Like, we started moonlighting back in September of 2015. We incorporated November of 2015, and then we launched the product that we're working on today, June of 2016.
There you go. Okay. So what did the first 60 days look like when you launched Loom in its first iteration?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the first version of what we built was under a moniker called Open Test, and it was supposed to be a next-gen version of usertesting.com.
Yep.
And we just felt like there was an opportunity to build a better UI, UX, and a better network of testers. And our first application of that was to have product experts, whether designers, product managers, engineers, that could give feedback at any stage of the product lifecycle, whether it's like a PRD or prototypes or something that was in production. And we just built and deployed that as rapidly as we possibly could. Like, we are trying to brute force some sort of like earned secret, is what I like to call it. And we launched that on Product Hunt. It was one of those like classic, we got a bunch of users and signups within the first 12 hours. And then the very next day, it basically went back to zero again. But it was enough people to get feedback, which was the fact that we actually have full-time people that are product managers and designers. Like, we don't want to pay people for their time in order to give us feedback. We'd actually really like, because we had built a video component, which was like screen recording with a superimposed camera bubble on top of it. And they're like, actually, can we get feedback from real-time users on our website? And so we went off and then we built that over the course of the next couple months. Once we launched that, we very quickly got feedback that like, hey, we actually just want to have this screen recording with camera bubble on top of it in order to record day to day. Like, we don't want it associated with some sort of survey. And so we separated that out and launched that. And so all of that happened over the course of 9 months, right? From basically September to June. And so the first 60 days after we launched what we're working on today, which is Loom, it was within the first couple days that I always tell the story about. I was at a friend's wedding on Saturday and Sunday, and we had like launched Loom on a Friday, and we had only 14 days of runway left. Like, this is including $25,000 worth of angel checks and then all of our personal savings. Like, we were going like all in, credit card debt, all that stuff. And this was kind of like our last ditch effort in order to see, can we launch something that gets traction? And so that Saturday when I woke up, the first thing I did was open our analytics dashboard at the time, and we were getting more signups per hour than we were the previous day when we had launched on Product Hunt. And I turned to my girlfriend at the time, now wife, and I go, we did it. I don't know what we did, but we did it, because it was not that like straight line up and then straight line back down right after it. And so the first few days was like, and weeks and months was actually just trying to learn what change were we bringing to the world. What could async video be for people at work? And so, you know, it was basically crash course in terms of what did we deploy and what value does it offer folks?
Yeah, interesting. Because I've been in the online space for what, 10, 11, 12 years. And I remember when Loom first came out, because before that, the product that I used to use, I think it was called Bing or Zing or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? And you used to have to pay for it. Oh, it was a common screen sharing tool and you could record, and it was a real pain to be able to share. And what was special about Loom was, yes, you had your 10-minute limit, but you had to try and get it done in 10, you had to try and finish the recording in 10 minutes, but it was really easy to record and it was really easy to share. But there were other products out there in the market, I remember, but nothing is good, and it was free and it was awesome. Like, what? Why did you decide at first not to charge for the product and go for a mass user adoption play?
There's a couple different things within there. One is that I want to give a ton of credit to my co-founder and Loom CTO, Vinay, in terms of like the differentiation from what existed in the market before Loom, which is We always, like, QuickTime screen recording had existed for 20 years prior to that. Right? There was many other screen recorders on the market. And what he did and said was really important was that videos need to render instantaneously. So instead of having to, like, manually upload something to YouTube or Google Drive or, you know, Dropbox that takes, you know, 5-10 minutes back in, like, 2016 era, a video was rendered instantly. And, like, you could take that link and you could share it with others. And so that was, like, the key differentiator, was that we took a lot of the manual work out of, like, what async video could be used when recording on your screen, and we made it instant. So that, I think, was, like, the biggest differentiator for Loom beyond some of the user experience stuff that we tried to steal, like, copy and paste from consumer products that we felt like were doing video incredibly well. But then when it came to monetization, honestly, the reason why we didn't have monetization for right out of the gate and all the way up through our Series A, which we can get into the story there in terms of the challenge of getting to that stage, was the fact that, like, we just didn't have time or resources to do it, to build pricing and packaging associated with limits and features and all that good stuff. Like, we were just trying to survive. Like, we were trying to build something that we felt like had proof of value and enough users and usage in order to get to the first round of funding or pre-seed. So it wasn't like this intentional decision to say, hey, should we monetize or optimize for more users? We literally did not have time in order to build monetization in that first kind of initial launch.
Yeah, got you. So how many pivots did you do and how long before you reached Loom, like in its form today? And how long did it take?
I'd say that was that September 2015 through June 2016 timeframe. It was 9 months. And it was two major pivots that we went through in order to land on what we've been building now for, you know, seven and a half years, which is Loom. The core of it is, like, video recording and sharing and making that as purpose-built for work as possible.
And when it comes to kind of, I guess, for founders watching this, listening to this podcast, what advice would you give them when it comes to, I guess, finding product market fit? Because there was every reason for you to continue on that particular traction with that particular product or the various previous iterations. And you probably would have been able to find some form of traction eventually where you could get customers, you could build a business. Like, yeah, what distinguishing factors, what advice would you give?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because I was just actually sending to an early stage founder a couple months ago, our pre-seed deck, which I hadn't opened for years, but we actually were still pitching the core platform and product, which was OpenTest at the time, which was like a user feedback platform. And then there was like a few slides on like, hey, we have this, we had not rebranded to Loom at this point. It was called OpenVid, was the Chrome extension. We were like, oh, by the way, there's also this Chrome extension that has like 5,000 users on it already. And like they've recorded, you know, 25,000 videos. And that was like burying the lead. You know, a lot of investors were like, why is that on slide 8? You know, why isn't that on slide 2? And we were confused at that time. You know, like we thought that OpenVid was actually going to be this user attraction platform that would feed back into testers on the, you know, OpenTest platform, that we would have more companies that would run more tests, but we'd also have this OpenVid tool that would be more like a viral go-to-market and awareness offering. And so when we were raising our pre-seed, to be clear, there was one investor that was like, we will fund you all if you like triple down on the user testing platform versus OpenVid. And we actually, as founders, we were like, okay, which one do we want to work on? Which one do we think is most interesting and most exciting? And fundamentally, there's a couple different reasons why we ended up focusing on async video. One is that the feedback that we were getting for the user testing platform was that it was going to be a very real like sales cycle in order to go after, call it like mid-market and enterprise companies. The three co-founders, I was a product manager by trade, Shahid was a designer by trade, and Vinay was an engineer by trade. None of us actually wanted to do enterprise sales in the early days. Like, we all looked at each other and were like, who's going to do this? You know, we were like, nobody raised their hand. And so then there was, at the time, PLG, product-led growth, was just kind of starting to be like talked about in earnest in this like 2016, 2017 era. And we're like, well, we have a viral product over here that is PLG in nature, and it's going to sell itself. It just felt like one was a lot more scalable and a lot easier for us to focus on the end user value and platform overall. And so that was kind of how we decided, was one was like, what skill sets existed? There's like the skill, will, bullseye. You know, like we didn't have the skill and we didn't have the will either. So like this business model doesn't really fit for us. And then the other side of it was just like, we had users coming in to the funnel every single day on OpenVid, what is now Loom, whereas on the OpenTest platform, we were getting put in Gmail spam account list because we were each sending 100, 150 emails per day for like emails that we scraped from the internet. And so we were like, that one is just not nearly as fun.
Yeah. So how do you create like a product like where people just naturally want to share it? And you talk about product-led growth. How do you get to that point? Was this by mistake that you guys got there? Because like, That's the dream, right? Like, you know, the paid acquisition game, or you know, long sales cycles, like tackling mid market or enterprise. That's a long game. Like, you know, product led growth is where it's at.
I talk to early stage founders about this all the time, which is clearly it took us like 9 months to get to a product that could spread itself. It was actually one of the like core questions that we were asking. So even when we had the user testing feedback platform before we had like Loom as like a separate video messenger, we were getting people to install this Chrome extension. And we felt like, oh, if we could get more people to install this Chrome extension, then we could use that in order to drive more users naturally into the platform through viral mechanisms. And so this was always something that we were thinking about, just because, like you said, it is a gold standard in order to get a PLG viral motion going. And so I always tell founders, I'm like, this is not going to be something that you figure out overnight. This is likely going to be a year plus journey for you to go on. And you just need to constantly keep this question top of mind. Because for us, like we always thought that this was an opportunity that we should be going after, just based off of our skill set of like engineering, product and design. And so when we did build what we launched in June of 2016, that was one of the things that Vinay was like, hey, if we want this to spread itself, if we want people to take a Loom link and share it with others, it needs to render instantly, versus right now, people will likely just think, oh, I just recorded something, I'm going to download it and then upload it to another sharing platform. And so, you know, like it came through like a series, and call it like months and months and months of being like, hey, how can we build a PLG component or a viral mechanism into the product? And then from there, you know, if you fast forward a little bit, we actually ended up making what we call video first views as our North Star metric. So a lot of people might think it's like the number of recordings in the platform. A lot of people might actually think that it's the total volume of video views that happen on the platform. No, like still to this day, we say video first view is our North Star metric, because every video can only have it triggered once. We know that communication happened on our platform if somebody didn't just send a Loom link out, but somebody actually viewed it. And so from there, that is the viral mechanism, which is like somebody else viewed a video that was recorded on the Loom platform. And the more videos that end up getting video first views is the like gold standard for us, because then it also pairs with the fact that we wanted to build day-to-day communication using async video. So a video that's recorded once but gets 50,000 views is not as valuable as 10,000 videos that get 50,000 views, because there's just more value that aligns with the change that we were trying to bring to the world. So we made our North Star metric virality oriented.
Yeah, no, it's super clever. And like, it's such a great product. And you're bringing me back to the pains that I had and how I started using Loom and actually became sticky, because yeah, that rendering piece was annoying. Like the old software that I used to use, it was similar to yours, and it was by like a reputable software company. Like they did a suite of tools. They used to have a screenshot tool as well. I can't, do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do, yeah, now that you said,
It was like Zing or something. I can't remember.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, but I remember I used to use that tool, and I used to pay for the screenshot tool and then the screen recording tool, and it would take ages to upload and share it back with somebody. And so, yeah, no, you guys just nailed it. And this is your first business, right?
Well, I mean, I had the design agency, which I actually felt like I learned a lot of like the business fundamentals about like, call it what is important from like a craft perspective, what is important from like G&A perspective on like finances and all of that good stuff. And so it wasn't my first time kind of realizing, I think the most important thing for all founders when you're asking like, you know, what advice that I generally have in terms of like product market fit or learning. It's like what I learned from having an agency is it is like the velocity that you move, right? Like how much can you get done every single day is the amount of learnings that you'll get every single day. So like if you are maximizing your learnings every single day, that compounds over the course of time. And I think that that's the most important thing for founders generally, is especially in the earliest days, is like, what earned secrets have you gotten? And usually that comes through direct kind of like brute force and velocity and moving as quickly as possible. So technically my first software company that I started, but not first company.
And you said you guys were going all in. You're down to credit cards. What was your backup plan if it didn't work? Did you have one? What was going through your mind? Because for many people listening, watching, hearing this, that's pretty scary. And some of us have been there. I've had times where it's just like, well, we're cutting it fine. And for some people, it doesn't work out, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that to some degree, when you're in that window of time, like, what is your coping mechanism? A lot of people just put the blinders on. It's like, did I have a backup plan? The like, as far as that thought got was, I have student debt. I'm living in California currently, which is notoriously one of the most expensive, you know, states to live in the United States. And so I would have to go back to living with my parents, which right after school, I was living in their basement for like 6 months. And I had a job as a caddy, like carrying golf clubs for 5 years. And so I was like, well, I know I can make good cash and I can live in my parents' basement for free back in Chicago. And then I'd figure it out from there. So at least I had like a some sort of like landing pad. But that was as far as the thought had gotten, is like, yeah.
Yeah, so you had a somewhat of a doomsday plan, and you played it out in your mind that it's not possibly as bad as you would think. Because I think sometimes we catastrophize these things, right? When it's all on the line, really, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that I would say is like it's not just blinders on and coping mechanism. It's what were Vinay, Shahid, and I all feeling when we were building every single day? Yes, it was hard. Yes, we were doing like 16-hour days, 7 days per week. We had been doing it for 8 months at that point. We were like long-term exhausted, not just like, you know, didn't get enough sleep the night before. But we all, and we asked each other this, we still, you know, Shahid has gone on to do his own thing starting back in 2019. But Vinay, Shahid, and I, we got good advice from other founders, which is like we did Sunday dinner together every single Sunday. And this was like actually to get away from the business as much as possible and talk to each other about what's top of mind. And one of the questions we would ask ourselves back then is like, hey, do we still want to do this? You know, like, are we having fun? And all of us felt like we were doing the right thing, we were in the right place. Like we weren't questioning that. At even like 2 weeks prior to running out of funds, we were all like, I wouldn't trade off being anywhere else and doing anything else. So let's just keep going.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, look, you eventually went on late last year. So, recording this early 2024, you went on to sell Loom in late 2023 to Atlassian. So, you're in Atlassian headquarters right now in Sydney. Would have been great to catch up in person. We didn't get there, but you sold it for $975 million. So, it's quite the feat, incredible growth. I'm curious, What did you have to learn from, I guess, making that transition from those early stage scrappy days to then you've got a product that's growing super fast, building teams, scaling, managing infrastructure, leadership, people management, all of that stuff?
Yeah, like you said, all of it. Look, I think one of the most critical moments for us to go from being a product to a company is when you start generating revenue. And I actually think that there's quite a bit of scar tissue from a lot of SaaS companies coming out of like the 2022, 2023 era, which is like, how do we think about not just growth, but like sustainable growth? And I had hinted at kind of like the Series A was a real challenge for us because we were like still optimizing for user growth at all costs. And we had not generated a dime of revenue when we were going to raise our Series A. A lot of investors actually took that as like a filter function of Loom of being like, I can't invest in a Series C or a Series A B2B SaaS company with no revenue. That's like, that makes no sense. And I wish that like in terms of going back in time, I actually wish that we had started monetizing earlier. I think that it actually just aligns so many forces across the company in a really powerful way, which is like, what do your customers care about? But what do they care about enough to pay for? And then from there, how do you end up creating systems and structures within the organization in order to make sure that you are serving your customers in the best way possible that then allows you to capture some of that value? And so I think that when it comes to all of the things that you asked me about, like, you know, what did I learn over the course of that time? Another thing that I think was really challenging as like a B2B SaaS company that was PLG in nature is how do you actually layer on going up market and an actual sales-led motion, I think is another like challenging window of time that again is like oriented towards monetization. But there's a great series of blog posts from this gentleman named Oliver Jay named the PLG Trap, that if anybody out there is working on a company that has some virality or wants to build a PLG company, like go out and read those blog posts, because it was exactly what Loom went through, which is that, you know, we struggled to go up market, call it back in like 2020 or 2021. I mean, we've cracked some of that now at this point, but yeah, then there's like the CEO role is a perpetual gauntlet is what I'd call it, is that like every 90 days I would create my own kind of like personal OKRs, and it changed what was the most important thing. I may be in one quarter saying that I'm hiring a VP of engineering because our CTO is like, hey, I'm like struggling from an operational and management perspective. Like we should bring in somebody who scaled teams before. And having to hire a VP of Eng for the first time, to the next thing is like your next most important thing is figuring out how to sell, you know, five-figure contracts the very next quarter. Like that's just like a world of difference, you know? And so like that never stopped. Every 90 days was radically different. But I think that the most important thing that you can do is be ruthless with your prioritization and honest about what the company needs to do in order to get to that next stage, to that next step. What my chief of staff and I talk about every day is like one foot in front of the other. That is kind of like the entrepreneurial journey. Just make sure that you pull up once every 30 or 90 days and make sure that you're going in the right direction. And then from there, one foot in front of the other.
So I'm curious as well around monetization. You said it's something you wish you did sooner. How did you work out what users were willing to pay for?
So this is another one that I'm kind of farming it out to a different resource, but there's reforge.com is like, think of it like a online kind of like MBA specifically for like tech folks, but have different programs. And so back in like 2017, 2018, there was only eight of us at Loom at the time. And we all went through the same Reforge program, which was like how to go zero to one on monetization. The perfect thing for us to like all go through. And it's such a solid framework, which was three core components. One is like core value proposition of the platform. And so they actually take you through how to actually get at that like core essence, because a lot of times platforms, like there's one core variable that people are willing to pay for us beyond price point, right? Like, so like setting price point aside, it was video limits. So you had mentioned like, you know, 10 minute limit that Loom had initially, but like, you know, we eventually dropped that to 5 minutes. And so what we learned from our users, it's not like video organization and folders. It's not the number of video views that their videos accumulate. What people were willing to pay for is like unlocking the length of time that they could record for and unlocking unlimited volume of recording. So like beyond 25 videos, they can record as many as they want without thinking about it. That was the core value of Loom. Then the second thing is like what you call max diff survey. So you create prototypes of various features that you could build. So I'll run through some examples. One is like a drawing tool, right? Like, does it make my creation better or more beautiful? There's another side of it, which is like video analytics. You know, who watched my video? How long did they watch it for? Is it integrations that you could build, like a Salesforce integration? You actually create like this relatively robust list of features. Ideally, you pair that up with prototypes, and then you do a max diff survey, which is like you put a series of four features in there and you have to pick what is the most valuable and what is the least valuable. And then you run them through these permutations, like 10, 12 cycles of the same user. And then on the other side, we had passed in all of their user data. And so we could see what was most important to a salesperson, what was most important to an engineering, what was most important to an executive, what was most important to company size and stage. And we were able to like slice and dice all of this different data in order to say, well, are we actually going to build a vertical offering for a certain persona, or are we going to go horizontal and what's broadly valuable to a lot of different individuals? And we ended up deciding to go horizontal, which is like another story that we could probably like dig into about like how and why we went horizontal versus vertical. And so then the third component, which is like price point. And there's this tried and true kind of method called Van Westendorp price point analysis. So you ask four questions, which is like, when is my product so cheap I question the value? What is the price point that I was like, it's a bargain, I'm absolutely paying for it? What is the upper bound of the price that I'd be willing to pay? And then the fourth one is, what is like too expensive, I would never even consider it? And you end up creating these four lines that intersect with each other. And depending on what kind of product and company that you're building, you pick one of those intersection points in order to price your product at. And because Loom decided to go horizontal in nature, that we wanted to monetize as many volume of users as possible without hurting our virality, we picked the like lower bound of the price point, which is like, I wish that we hadn't gone through this like 3 month process to determine what price we should charge, because it came out as $10 per user per month. I could have looked at any B2B SaaS pricing page and been like, yep, that's the entry starting price point. You know, it's like 10 bucks. So anyways, we went through this like very robust sort of how to go 0 to 1 on monetization across core value prop, across max diff features and which features are most valuable to others, and then what would be the willingness to pay and price point. And that became our monetization roadmap.
Got you. Why'd you decide, you have to answer this one after we're of course wrapping up, why'd you decide to go from, instead of vertical, going horizontally?
I think that there was, we actually got a lot of pushback from early investors about going horizontal versus vertical, because horizontal is really difficult. And vertical is, we could have built Loom for sales and pretty much set up a sure path to get scooped up by Salesforce for like a couple $100 million is what one investor told us. And we decided to go horizontal because, again, this was like a Sunday conversation between three co-founders where like, do we feel like we captured lightning in a bottle to some degree? Like, do we feel like this is actually like a horizontal application mode of communication? And to be clear, we did have some data-informed perspective here, which is like, if you looked at split it by persona, like engineering, success, sales, marketing, support, founder, it actually wasn't super clear that any persona like disproportionately valued Loom. There's like psychographic profile components of individuals that like some engineers just really got it from day one and loved async video about how it could replace meetings on their calendar, and that they like didn't need to show up to these pointless meetings. And support people loved Loom because they could make a personal connection by not just sending like a canned message back to somebody. Let me walk you through and show you how to solve this, that increased their CSAT. And so it wasn't very clear that there was one disproportionate persona that saw more value in Loom. And so we were like, I think we've captured lightning in a bottle and that we're going to go horizontal in nature. And to be clear, this kind of dovetails and pairs with what I was saying earlier, which is the fact that PLG Trap is actually like a great blog post to read, because it talks about when you go horizontal in nature in PLG, eventually you will run into a moment where like you have to build vertical for some, whether it's an industry or whether it's for a certain persona, because that's where you can end up driving more effective revenue over the course of time. So Loom has started building Loom for Sales now 7 years on, when it was like a seed investor that told us back in like 2017, you should build Loom for Sales. So he wasn't wrong. He was just early, is what I'd say.
No, that's interesting. You would think, though, you would have chosen, because us as humans, we love certainty. You'd think you would have chosen the more stronger pathway that led to more certainty. Like most founders listening to this right now going, okay, if I have one pathway where it's probably a bigger opportunity, bigger market, but it's going wider, much more challenging, versus this other pathway where it's much more certainty, choosing a vertical, it's clear. Like I know people that, like I get pitches all the time from people that are using a Loom video and they make it look as if it's customized and it's not, and it's a sales pitch and it's from a cold email outreach. Like that is very, very clear. Why didn't you choose the path that was more certain? Like you said, it would have got scooped up by Salesforce for a couple hundred million, sure thing.
So I would say that there's it's not that we took the like most risky path every step of the way. There was this, when we did launch what became Loom, there was actually, call it one third was work users, one third was personal users, one third was like education use cases. And so like we had this, does that mean that like we could build a consumer product and platform? Like, could we actually bring async video on the desktop that didn't really exist, but was clearly like a video recording and sharing on mobile was very valuable in the consumer platform? Like we talked to each other as like, do we want to start a consumer app or do we want to start like B2B software? And we decided B2B because we're like, that actually has a lot less risk to it. Consumer apps are like extremely binary. It's like when you win, you like really win, but like, you know, 99.9999% of consumer apps end up failing. So we didn't always like choose the most risky path. But when it came to why didn't we go vertical and build for sales personas, to us, there is no moment where you will have perfect information. And I think like great leaders, this is an Amazon principle, like great leaders are right a lot. And I think that you just have to like trust your instinct at the end of the day, because you are never going to have perfect information with all the problems and challenges that you're solving day in and day out, week over week. And so you just kind of have to, you know, go with your gut. And the three of us collectively as co-founders, we're like, we're building horizontal. That's like what our gut tells us that we should do. And so I think that that to me is like, there's no like, you know, here's the data that told us we should go horizontal. It was just what we all felt was collectively right.
Hmm. You made the right call. And 7 years later, you're doing a vertical.
Yeah, well, stacked on top of a horizontal platform, you know? So like, and this is something that, you know, I talked to Brett Taylor, who was, you know, co-CEO of Salesforce for a little bit. And he was like, every platform does get to this like vertical opportunity. You know, like if you look at Salesforce, it is horizontal, relatively horizontal in nature, but then they built these like vertical across industries. And so all this to say is like every platform will eventually get there.
It makes sense. And look, I look at it with what we're doing with Founder. We've gone kind of broad, but then over time now we're just going just mainly focus on the e-commerce vertical from a product monetization standpoint.
Yep.
That's cool. So we're going to move to the hot seat round. We've got to wrap. Rapid fire questions and answers. First one I've got is finish this sentence. Loom wouldn't be successful if...
if we didn't care deeply about the like crafts and user psychology side of what it takes to change behavior.
What's been the hardest business lesson to learn?
How to... for me personally, it was like increasing my financial literacy. That was feedback that I got from our Series B board member. He was like, you got to increase your financial literacy. And that was really hard for me.
Mm. Even with a solid CFO.
To be clear, like, I think resource allocation is one of the most important things that any founder can do, regardless of role, any executive. And so in terms of understanding and seeing what levers that you have in the business that you can pull, and it really does force you to understand the sensitivity model that you potentially have within your business, that I just need to increase my financial literacy.
Yep, fair. Thank you. What daily habit makes you better at your work?
Meditation.
If you could have a dinner with any entrepreneur, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
It's kind of a trope, but I'll give a little caveat to it, which is I'd say Steve Jobs on a bad day that is familiar with Loom, because I feel like I've listened to or read many stories about how he's like ripped a company or products. And I feel like tough love and tough feedback is one of the greatest gifts that you could give to someone. And Steve Jobs is one of the best product builders of all time. So Steve Jobs on a bad day.
Love it. And then the last one is, what are you excited about next?
I'm excited to actually for this next chapter with Atlassian. Genuinely, I think that we have one of the most exciting roadmaps that Loom has ever had over the next 12 months in terms of, I think we collectively of like company builders are really lucky in this window of time about like the burgeoning AI ecosystem and everything that it opens up from like an opportunity perspective to deliver value for customers. But then also, how do you do that alongside the PLG OG company, which is Atlassian, that has a plethora of different products that we are going to be integrating with relatively aggressively, that we can learn so much about how to better serve the enterprise segment. And man, in just like 100 days, I've learned so much than like call it the previous year leading up to acquisition. So really excited for the next chapter with Atlassian.
Awesome. Well, Joe, thank you so much for your time and all of your experiences, lessons, stories that you've shared with us and our community. It's really going to help a lot of people. So thank you so much and congratulations on all your success thus far and for building an incredible product that our company uses every single day. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Nate.
Hey guys, if you love this episode, make sure to check out my interview with Trini Woodall on how she built a diehard community of followers backing her every single move with Trini London.
The true beauty of our community is that there's a passion and we inspire a passion for them to make the most themselves. But that community itself fosters, you know, lifting up women.